You're listening to The Local Maximum, episode 76.
Time to expand your perspective. Welcome to The Local Maximum. Now, here's your host, Max Sklar.
Welcome, everyone. You have reached another Local Maximum. This is episode 76, joined by my co-host, Aaron, as usual today. Aaron, how are you doing?
Good. Good evening, good morning, good whatever time it is, wherever you're watching and listening.
Well, by the time we're recording this a little bit early, about a week early, because by the time this goes out on my podcast feed, I am going to be in Lviv, Ukraine. And so I don't know what time it'll be when it goes out for me. I will try to make sure the thing goes out at the right time, the right time frame, at the right time zone. So you will get your recording Monday night, as usual. What's the date that this goes out Monday night? It's going to be 6 days from today.
Which what is that, the 22nd?
Yes, July 22nd this goes out. It's actually going to be the day after an election in the Ukraine. I told that could be a little bit dicey, but we'll see what happens there. I'm actually there to teach a course on Bayesian thinking for applied learning at Ukraine Catholic University. So they have like a little summer school data science summer school. And I've been told that like 40 people signed up for my class. So
that's cool.
Yeah.
Well into the double digits.
And it's a 9 hour. I have 9 hours of instruction to do. So hopefully I get that right. Any advice for me there? They want me to make slides, but I'm like 9 hours of slides. I think I'm just going to do some of this the old fashioned way, you know, notes and.
I don't know what the rule of thumb is when you're talking about some of the more advanced kind of machine learning topics, but
I don't think it's going to be.
Someone at some point told me that it was no more than one slide a minute, but at 9 hours that's still a lot of slides.
That's going to be way too many slides.
Well, complex the slide, the longer you can have it up while you talk about it.
Yeah, no, I just like topics and then talk about the topic. Some of the topics are going to be the ones that we talk about here on the show, Bayesian inference, the theoretical, like the philosophical underpinnings of probability to help you understand how to solve those problems. That's all really interesting. And then something else is going on today, which I announced on the podcast last time. But this week, I am back at Foursquare, and I didn't think that was going to happen. But hey, it happened. And so
you thought you were out, but they pulled you back in.
Is that from a
all over again?
That's from Godfather?
I believe so. It's been a while since I've rewatched any of it.
Yeah. All right. I tried to put my job description on LinkedIn. Why don't I read that and see if we can critique it? Joining the Foursquare Labs team with some great engineers and the executive chairman to build fun and amazing products on top of Foursquare's tech for all of you to enjoy as you move about the world. The focus will be on product research and rapid prototyping. I will also be doing internal consulting and training on Foursquare's machine learning and statistical solutions throughout the tech and product stack. So I don't know how this is going to go, but I think it's going to be a lot of fun. So at least that'll be in there. And great. Hopefully every few weeks I'll have like a new product launch that I can announce here on the Local Maximum saying, hey, this is available now.
Well, that's exciting, and I look forward to continuing to be a beta tester for some of these things.
Yeah, well, we might do
I got in on the ground floor for MarsBot, so that was exciting back in the day. I can't believe it's been that long.
Yeah, it's 2 years. Whatever I do, it always comes back in 2 years as like a good thing, but nobody likes it at the time. Well, people like MarsBot, but all these things are like a tough sell for the company. It's always tough, when you're not, the company's like, okay, we'll put a few people in R&D, but we don't really have an idea of what our return on investment is. And it's always concerning when you get the feeling that they might thank you in a few years, but while you're going through it, they're not really, you don't get any support. But we'll see. It seems like, Foursquare is really at the forefront of some of the product R&D now, or hopes to be. So I hope to move that forward, and maybe we'll make some decisions to try to build a better internet than the one we have now with all your apps driving you crazy. Hopefully we'll have your apps making you smiling and giving you good value.
I guess a better internet isn't quite the the dirty buzzword. A new internet is definitely the dirty buzzword, but I feel like that's that from a couple of years ago in Silicon Valley.
Yeah, that hasn't been on the air for a little while, but I don't think we're building a new internet, just new applications. Anyway.
Before we move on, can we take a step back to something you mentioned earlier? So when you're in Ukraine, I guess I got two questions. One is, will they be providing you with a translator, or is the expectation that everyone there is functionally fluent in English?
It's an English language course. I'll put the course up. Yeah, and it's called Bayesian Thinking for Applied Machine Learning. I'm going to do an intro to Bayes' rule and its history in solving problems. In fact, I'll turn that into a show. Conjugate priors, that might be tough to turn into a show. Markov chain, Monte Carlo. We did a show on that, episode 4, but we could revisit that. Monte Carlo is always fun. It's like moving around randomly until you find a solution. I mean, that sounds really bad. It's better than that, but still, it's based on that. So, and today we're actually going to talk a little bit about a machine learning product called Word2Vec that Google came out with. It's one of the positive things we're saying about Google today. And we're going to talk about how that's used in making scientific discoveries. So we'll get to that at the end of the program. To start the program, we're going to talk a little bit about a lot of Bitcoin's been in the news still. And then Google and all their shenanigans in terms of their,
such a fun word, shenanigans.
I love that term because it makes it think like, oh, they're like lots of people, they're getting into trouble, when really it's just a bunch of people sitting in front of a screen. Getting into trouble in like a funny comedic way, like it would be fun to watch.
Someone's going to get a pie in the face.
Yeah, exactly. I don't think that's happening. But hey, are they trying to influence the election? That's an interesting topic of discussion. So first, thank you for listening to the Jeff Tucker episode today. You told me that you listened to it a little bit, right?
I did, yes.
And a lot of people out there listened to it because today was the highest downloaded day of the Local Maximum. Again, we keep hitting records. Like every few weeks, we hit another record. And so I'm glad that people are seeing the value in what we do here and trying to give people different perspectives. I know, someone like Jeffrey Tucker, he's often talking to, the political philosophy folks, but I try to steer it in the direction of kind of innovators and product makers and try to see what he had to say about that. So I thought that was a lot of fun.
Yeah, there's a lot of, they may be short edges, but shared edges between those spaces.
Yeah. And so one thing that he said really stuck out when looking at the news today, which was, he said, when Bitcoin was created, and I'm paraphrasing here, but he basically said, when Bitcoin was created, we have to admit that we don't really know what money is before the creation of Bitcoin. And now a lot of people say, okay, now we see Bitcoin, and then we turn around and say, okay, now I definitely know what money is. When you're kind of, well, let's talk about it in Bayesian terms. When you're really sure about something, but then you see some strong evidence of something else, then your standard deviation should get blown out, and you're like, I don't really know the answer here. I'm less certain about it. So no, that's a good point. I don't think that anyone would have guessed. I mean, Bitcoin was supposed to be peer-to-peer cash, but it's turned into, yes, it could be peer-to-peer cash, but primarily digital gold right now. And if you think about it, yeah, it should be a good store of value before, like when two people are exchanging, the technical problem of how do we do the exchange using our technology, whether it's our watch or our phone or our computer, that's a totally different problem than what denomination you're changing. And so Bitcoin is an entirely different denomination. And so it's interesting to note that. That's one thing I really agreed with him on and took to heart. Like, yeah, you got to be very humble in this space because that sort of matches my own expectations in not being very good at predicting what's going on in this space.
Well, I'm going to jump ahead a little bit and
go for it.
And throw out a Trump quote here. Right? I guess.
Yeah.
I guess it's a quote of a tweet from the Business Insider article. But
so it should be pointed out here. This is the first time the President of the United States has weighed in on cryptocurrencies.
And he said, quote, I am not a fan of Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies, which are not money and whose value is highly volatile and based on thin air. My response to which is, and what is the US dollar based on? Because not based on the gold standard or any fungible assets. It's based on a promise that will pay debts. And
I'll tell you what they say. They say, first, it's backed by a country which has an army. And second, they'll say...
That takes you down a road that gets real ugly real fast.
Well, let me tell you, like, we had, in the United States, U.S. history, and there are other countries have similar histories, we had hyperinflation during the Revolutionary War. We had the Continental Dollar, and that didn't go very well for them. People lost their savings there.
There was a similar problem during the Civil War with both governments printing endless currency to fund the war effort.
Right, and I believe it was Hamilton put us on the gold standard after to prevent that.
When
from
did
happening.
War bonds become a thing? Was that around during the Civil War, or was that more of a World War One invention?
I don't know.
I've taken this way off topic. Sorry.
Yeah. I want to say World War One.
Back to inflation.
Another point they'll make is that the dollar is backed by the fact that you can pay taxes in dollars, but that's not. Well, that's not really true because there's no guarantee of how many dollars you're going to need to pay your taxes. So it'd be one thing if the government says, okay, you own this land, right? $1,000 is guaranteed to pay your taxes every year. It's like, no, we're not going to tell you how much taxes are good. Like, the tax on this property could be something totally different in 10 years, and it could be many more dollars. So it's not really the greatest argument. But it does have going for it is network effects and the fact that other world currencies are worse. It'll be interesting to see whether crypto goes after the dollar first or whether it starts eating up some of these other world currencies that are not as good.
I will not be the first and certainly not the last to point out that Trump is not an economist and he is certainly not a monetary policy expert. So I feel that he has very little to,
although
very
he
little
wants
leg
low
to stand on to comment on the place that Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies have in our economic model. But
he said
but that's
low
never stopped
rates.
Him before.
Big brain, low interest rates. He's also very good on trade, the best on trade. So that didn't come out of nowhere, which is really interesting. It's certainly, he was definitely directing his attack there at Facebook's cryptocurrency, and so
which I think is fair, but not. I wouldn't make this. I would criticize them, but from a different tack. But to bring it back to what Jeffrey Tucker was saying that this whole we apparently we didn't know what money is, but do we now know? And I think and we still don't know what money. What old money is, and certainly not what this new dimension of money is. And if we're fooling ourselves if we try to answer that in the affirmative.
Right. And we can come up with some ideas. Like, I have the idea that, okay, Bitcoin is finite in value, unlike any other hard resource like gold, even though gold is the closest to finite you're going to get when it comes to materials.
It is finite in the way that any natural resource is.
But more so. Gold.
Gold, I mean, yes.
Yeah. Yeah, gold is because it's very difficult to extract, and so
it's in the same category as oil or phosphorus or lithium or any of those kind of mineral type resources.
Except a lot of that stuff, you can take it out of the ground really easily, but then it gets used up. Whereas gold, you can take it out of the ground much more. It's much more difficult, and once it's out of the ground, it stays in the hands, like it doesn't decay or anything like that. So really, the global supply of gold is actually pretty stable, which is why it's the best money. But now we have forms of money, and Bitcoin isn't the only one. It's just the biggest one, where it's actually, actually limited. Like, we know how much there is,
right.
And there'll never be any more.
And how much there'll ever be.
Yeah, and so... is that where we're going in terms of the direction of hard objective money? That's one of my hypotheses that I put some good prior juice on. Some good some
good back
on. But I'm not gonna say I know what money is, but that's sort of my that's one theory, you know, that I sort of follow. But yeah, it's really fascinating. If Bitcoin is the emerging global standard, this is exactly how it would happen. It starts in fits and starts, and at first it's all scammy.
Or even to generalize a little bit more, not necessarily Bitcoin, but right. some type of cryptocurrency.
Right, right.
And now have they come up with a new name for it? Because cryptocurrency, I know the crypto part. We've talked in the past about cryptocurrency and crypto Jews and crypto this and crypto there's an implication that comes with the use of the prefix crypto, which I feel it's like hidden. The currency should move beyond. But,
right.
but I
it
haven't
sounds
heard
like,
an alternate convention
secret,
for that.
It sounds like secret currency.
Yeah,
almost.
which is an element of it, but certainly not the defining element, I think.
Right.
Because there's and this is mostly beyond my understanding, but there's public coins and private coins and security coins, and they all fall under this cryptocurrency umbrella.
So, crypto means secret, but it's not secret money. It's money based on secrets, which is
that doesn't sound much better.
Yeah, no. But
it's also the most transparent money.
Yeah, yeah. In some ways.
So let's bring that back. You mentioned before
certainly
that part of
in
the
terms
reason,
of certainly more transparent in terms of monetary policy.
Yeah,
yeah.
You're saying part of the reason that this came up, what you think prompted Trump to break his lifelong silence on cryptocurrency, is the advent of the Facebook coin. It's not a Facebook coin, but it is a cryptocurrency with significant backing from the Facebook corporation.
And it hasn't been the advent yet. It's just proposed, which I think there's a good chance this doesn't get off the ground at all. It's so hard. Look, the fact that it's being attacked left and right, it's so easy for these big companies to kind of get deterred into doing something else that it just seems like this is not going to work. And even if, like, you can't just say, okay, Facebook has all these users, so they're going to get all these users using Libra. No, they have a good channel to get people to use it from, but they're still starting from scratch, and it's not going to be that easy. And
if they
advertise it on their platform, they're giving up something else. Like, they're giving up advertising space that they could be used to be making money elsewhere. They still calculate it that way. So it's almost like a startup within – it's a lot harder than people think. And I talked about that with Miriam in episode 72, I think.
Yeah, and I think one of the biggest things, the caveat, is I've seen numerous mentions of, oh, this is an opportunity to provide a means of exchange to the unbanked. And I call shenanigans. I'm gonna keep it PG-13. That all right. I think that rationale is absolutely, you can make a case for it, and it is completely hollow. It's a shell inside. There's no way that that's the motivation, and I would be flabbergasted if that's actually the result of this, assuming it does get off the ground.
I think they
see an opportunity to make not a cash grab, but almost a real estate, a market space grab here, that they want in on the coin thing. And they think that by being the 800-pound gorilla in the room, they can prevent some other large cryptocurrency from becoming the de facto mainstream version by inserting themselves there. And even if it dies on the vine, that by being there and sucking the air out of the room, they prevent somebody else from taking it and running with it.
Yeah. So if you look at Bitcoin's market cap is $167 billion. That's a lot, even for Facebook. And the idea that they're just going to come and swoop in on that is, it's not going to be that easy. Now, just because Trump tweeted it, he said he's not a fan, but it doesn't seem like he is fanatically opposed to it in terms of, like, we have to ban it or whatever. In fact, his Treasury Secretary Mnuchin came out recently and said, hey, you can invest in this, just don't do like legal stuff with it. So we thought that was interesting. And then Kevin McCarthy, who is the minority leader in the U.S. House of Representatives. He said, I like Bitcoin. So, wow, I mean, you have some political leaders accepting it. Do you know how long, 5 years, people have been telling me, oh, this is going to totally be banned? And it hasn't happened. Like, people were like, oh.
To be fair, there are countries where it has been banned.
Yeah, but none to the effect. Which, is there a country where it's like enforced really vigorously?
Well, I mean, how would you enforce it? But my understanding is that India passed something that's fairly restrictive.
Yeah. Yeah, but it hasn't.
And India is a billion people. That's what? One seventh, 1/6 of the world market right there?
Yeah. Yeah, but it hasn't been banned in the United States, and I bet they use it plenty in India. So you, talking about the difficulty of banning this technology, you found an article on sending Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies to each other via radio. Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, so this is, for starters, Bitcoin is not simple, or cryptocurrency in general is not simple. And this is like a level beyond that in complexity of getting geared up and using. But very relevant, I think, to some of the cases we've discussed in the past about using cryptocurrency, for example, in Venezuela or perhaps in Cuba or anywhere that you have unreliable connectivity and maybe even unreliable power grid, or you don't trust the networks that you're on. Then these are methods using satellite connections and ham radio that they are verifying and relaying elements of the blockchain beyond your internet service provider. So this could be very useful, particularly in those places where maybe the government is trying to crack down and prevent the use of this. And granted, it's not without risk in that kind of a scenario. They can still, you know, try and hunt you down for doing this, but it's a lot harder to stop than simply flipping a switch on the local ISP or putting some sort of DNS block on there.
So let me explain something about these Bitcoin transactions. When I want to transact with you, I digitally sign a transaction. Let's not get into how that works, but basically I come up with a bunch of data and I want to broadcast it widely. And it doesn't matter if everyone in the world sees it. It's secure. It's like an encrypted message. And it basically says, hey, I give you this value and I have proof that I signed it. And so that's actually turns out to be not that much data. One thing that Andreas Antonopoulos points out is that you can send a transaction in, I think it was 15 emojis is enough data on Skype. So 15 emojis.
Not literally emojis, just the data bandwidth equivalent, correct?
No, literally emojis. If there are X number of emojis available, and if you send 15 of those emojis, then there's enough data in there. If we come up with some method of transforming the emoji into a number and then putting the number and we figure out how to put the numbers together the right way, there's enough data in there, there's enough bits in there to send a transaction. So that's pretty interesting. In fact, someone should do that. Someone should come up with an emoji language for
this is almost an analog methodology for the promulgating of this digital cryptocurrency, which is it's almost steampunk in a way.
Yeah, very cool. And are people actually doing it, or is it just a theoretical thing?
I think there are people doing it, but I think at this point it's very much like it's the type of people who are already kind of ham radio nerds,
right?
And they're doing it not because they need to do this in order to be in the Bitcoin space, but because it's kind of a proof of concept and they think it's kind of cool. And, you know, it's good to have some people out there testing out this proof of concept in the event that something like this becomes critical for use. You don't want to be learning it under whether it be disaster scenarios or oppressive governments, because it's not just the scenario of, you know, there might be a revolution fomenting in Venezuela that something like this could be useful. But let's say you have a Hurricane Katrina type scenario, and there's no ATMs, There's no banks operating in a large swath of the country. But if you can have a network, a mesh radio network of ham operators set up with the ability to run this protocol over it, you could have a analog equivalent running the blockchain and make the digital exchange of currency possible in these areas, even with limited power grid functionality.
Well, you need two things. Like, I could send you a transaction. I could send you a transaction on a piece of paper, right? But so broadcasting it is one thing, but you'd have to actually be able to, you know, confirm it. And so that's going to be a little more difficult.
Well, right. And a network of people with this type of equipment would basically allow you to move that message from what would perhaps be considered a dead zone out into the wider network and spread it out without necessarily having direct access to a coin exchange wherever you happen to
be. But you'd have to be only need a node in the network, but you have to have ultimately they have to have access to someone who does.
Right. And you could certainly do this via SneakerNet. You could have somebody writing down sequences of numbers and smuggling them out of the country and then updating it once they get to somewhere that it's safe to do so or that they have access. But this is a way of automating and this somewhat without the kind of the high cost of transactions in terms of man hours and effort.
All right. So exchanging value when the grid is down, all that good stuff. A really tinfoil hat today. To continue on that, path.
Not all tinfoil hats are crazy.
Yeah. Is Google
quite fashionable?
Is Google working to elect a Democrat in 2020? That's the headline. I guess this story is, there was kind of a leak in Project Veritas, which we could talk about a little bit, that says that, Googlers, look, it's no secret that a lot of Googlers have a big stake in the next election. They really want to see Donald Trump defeated. In some ways I understand, but they really have this activist culture where I find it difficult to believe that people aren't bringing that into their day-to-day product decisions.
Yeah, and to be fair, some of this may be company culture, but I think a large part of it is they are a young company, both in terms of how long they've been around and in terms of
their
workforce.
Yeah,
and so having a large portion of your workforce being millennials, you're going to have an inherent lean towards more activism in this type of area.
Yeah.
So I'll cut them a little bit of slack there, but it sounds like we're moving beyond that in what's being discussed here.
Yeah. Okay. So can you go into a little bit more detail on what was discussed?
Yeah. So we're reaching back a little bit because I actually watched the video back when I was in Austria a couple of weeks ago. I guess there was a document that was leaked, as well as someone who they're referring to as a whistleblower from inside the company, who was talking, with their face obscured and their voice altered on the record. Plus, there was hidden camera footage from a lunch with a woman who it's been a while, so I'm forgetting what her title was, but she was involved in basically determining some of this, what content we want to promote and how to combat what we see as tampering in the election
and
how to prepare for 2020 based on 2016, and she said some things on camera that can be spun in either direction, I'd say.
Right. So it kind of sounds like it's I don't think that you get two people in a room and they agree on what's fair. And so
Well, and that was one of the things that they got her on tape saying, which they one side of the argument would cite as a gotcha, which is she said something to the effect of, there's a large swath of America that does not agree with me on what I think, what I think slash what we think at Google is fair, and is truthful, honest, accurate speech. And she was openly recognizing that there's a large segment of the population that will disagree with that, with the implication of tough cookies were making that decision.
Yeah. Well, one thing that you could do to check that is really interesting, if you look at Google's autocomplete, if you type in Hillary Clinton's emails, the autocomplete is, you know, is empty. In other words, they clearly blacklisted that term from having autocomplete. Other figures, emails.
And not to go down the highly politicized one side or the other, just to point out that there are clearly certain search terms that they are I guess the term is blacklisting, that they're influencing what comes up in autocomplete and therefore having some effect on what people are searching for and finding.
Yeah.
And this is not to say that they're not doing it in both directions. This is just an example to show that they are in some ways manipulating what results we're going to see.
Sure, sure. I mean, the other search results haven't banned that. You can look at that directly. I think that, you know, every internet service and search engines have some degree of blacklisting, because sometimes you find things in there that are so ridiculous that they just need to be removed. And so, you know, for example, and this was, I mean, in Foursquare, we have blacklists from getting ratings, receiving a rating. So, for example, Auschwitz concentration camp was blacklisted from having a rating.
I'm sure there were plenty of people who were, you know, giving it 5 stars and making some very insensitive.
No, it wasn't tips. Even that. It wasn't even that. It was just people were rating the museum positively, and so then what happens is, it gets a really high review.
If you liked this place, then you might also like Auschwitz.
God.
Yeah,
that's bad too. No, it was just banned from having a rating. Like, no one wants to see, oh, it's a 9 out of 10 would return type situation.
Yeah. Well,
but that makes sense.
I generally speak very highly about DuckDuckGo as a search engine alternative, because there are a lot of things they do better than Google, I feel. However, I don't think that we could realistically say that they're not going to be blacklisting some things. It may be a very different list of things, but I think the big differentiator there is more what they do with your data as opposed to how they're influencing search results. Because if they weren't influencing search results, it wouldn't be it would be a less useful tool.
Sure, sure.
But the question is, how exactly are they influencing those search results? And is it to our benefit or our detriment?
Exactly. An interesting point that I want to make before we move on is just, you know, will this actually work? Because I think that Google, or rather the employees in Google who are involved in this, they might be overestimating their ability to affect the outcome of the election. And, you know, even if people search and see, I don't know. I mean, maybe if Google did it in like such an obvious way, but then, you know, they can't do it in an obvious way. So
it'll be fascinating to see
what I'm saying is, even if people search and see things, are they really paying attention to autocomplete? Is there really a direct connection to people's mind that if they see something in autocomplete, or they see this search above that search, that they're going to think about that when they're actually in the ballot box? I'm not.
That's an interesting psychology and sociology experiment.
We have this belief that you can, like, you know, just by the power of suggestion, just by flashing something on the screen, you can totally, like, remake the person's brain. But I don't know if that's
true. I would think
really
a bigger influence would be how far they bury a result beyond the first page of results.
Sure.
As opposed to autocomplete, which I'm sure there's some algorithm magic happening there, too.
I think
But
they could really hurt a down-ticket person if they, you know, if someone doesn't know about the person, and so they're Googling them as their main source of information. For the presidential candidates, that doesn't really work as well. So it remains to be seen, I think, if...
Yeah, well, what would be really interesting, and I'm going to throw something out there and suppose it's true for the sake of argument. So let's say that yes, indeed, the reason that Trump won in 2016 was because of massive Russian influencing of the election. So let's take that as a given for a moment. I think Facebook and Google and Twitter are very much caught in the same trap that the American military has been for the last 75 years, in that we are fighting, they are fighting the last war, and they are going to come up with great ways to prevent what happened in 2016 happening again. But by the time they implement those for 2020, whoever their adversary is will have evolved sufficiently that they're not going to see what hit them next time around.
Yeah. They're also assuming...
And maybe it's not the Russians. Maybe it's operatives within the Republican Party or some populist movement within the U.S. But I'm not convinced that what they're doing is going to actually address the new problem, whatever form that takes. Because there are people who are spending a lot of time working the social media monster to bend it to their will. And I'm not convinced they're going to be able to stop that.
Yeah, I think it's I think you're right about the fighting the last war part. They're also assuming that the election is going to be close, which we kind of make that assumption because in recent years, almost every election's been close. But if it's not close, there's not a whole lot you could do about it.
Well, if polling is to be believed at this point, it sounds like it's going to be a slam dunk for whoever comes out of the Democratic primary. But
the problem is
there's a lot of road between here and now.
Yeah, the problem is it's got to be one of them, and then you got to face the fact of who it is. You're right. The polls do look like that, but again, Obama won with 51% of the vote in 2012, and so nominating like a third-rate version of Obama seems like it's not going to do that. But the only way that you could say they could win is because they're running against Trump, who's not liked by a large section of the population, but he's a very very strong core. But something he's very good at is making his opponents self-destruct. And so I don't think they're even still, I don't think they're ready for that.
Well, so taking a step back for a moment to the Project Veritas video.
So I think, finally, just to close that out.
Go ahead.
Yes, in the end, it could be close. If it's not close, it could be not close in either way. Sorry, I'm doing a very uninformative prior here, but that's the situation.
It will be one of these three results.
Yes.
I can guarantee it. It will either be close or not close. And if not close, it will be not close in one of two ways.
Or asteroid just
all the bases
all
are covered.
Yeah.
But I was going to say that coming back to the Project Veritas video, like much of the stuff coming out of James O'Keefe's work, I can't imagine he's related to Georgia O'Keefe. That was a weird tangent my brain went on. But it's... This is not material that's going to convince somebody to kind of change their priors. This is very much going to reinforce whatever your opinion was about whether Google and other tech firms are in the tank for the Democrats, or whether they're simply trying to prevent trolls and outside influencers and foreign intelligence agencies from interfering. That there are pieces you can pull from that footage that reinforce both of those stories, and we're looking at the same material. And it's unfortunate that this is butting right up against you can have your own opinions but not your own facts. Well, the same facts here tell two different stories depending on what light you put them in. So this is only, I feel, going to entrench people further into whatever side they were predisposed to believe before seeing this. At the end of the day, nothing changes except everything's changing.
All right. So before we end, I want to move on. Can AI be used in making scientific discoveries? Well, it could be used, but is the AI actually doing science? So we found an interesting blog post on that from Joe Huffman, blog, joehuffman.org, recently. Researchers from Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory trained an AI called Word2Vec. By the way, they didn't train Word2Vec. Well, I'll talk about Word2Vec in a second. Trained an AI called Word2Vec on scientific papers to see if there was any latent knowledge that humans weren't able to grok on first pass. The study, published in Nature on July 3rd, reveals that the algorithm found predictions for potential thermoelectric materials which can convert heat into energy for various heating and cooling applications. So this was sort of an interesting AI Does Science article, and I want to dive a little bit into what's going on here. And I realize the way I talk about some of this stuff, it might be hard to understand. So, Aaron, I hope that you'll ask some good questions here. First of all, The Singularity Is Near, he used that as the title of his blog post. That's actually the title of Kurzweil's 2005 book, which I've read.
Which I think he may have linked that directly in his post.
So that book is – so Kurzweil is usually talking about the law of accelerating returns when it comes to information technology. That's related to Moore's Law, just technology getting faster and faster and faster.
He uses that term in relation to a technology explosion, as opposed to some people use it in the context of the jump from good AI to kind of super AI.
Right.
Moving to and beyond general intelligence.
Right. AI. Well, the idea is that, you know, AI is going to become so intelligent around 2045. There's some phase shift and everything's going to change. There are phase shifts all the time. In like mobile is one of them, where computers can now be in your hand. That's maybe not the most significant one, but it's the one I think you'd understand the most. But when the phase shift comes with intelligence, that's what's called like the singularity. Okay, finally we have these super intelligent computers. We don't have to go into that today. That's a lot. But so what's Word2Vec? I think it came out in 2012. I've been playing around with Word2Vec in 2012. It's a system that it trains on any text corpus you give it, which is like a bunch of, you know, documents, and it assigns each word a vector. That's what it means, Word2Vec. A vector meaning essentially a list of numbers, usually 300 numbers. We say that's a 300-dimensional space. But think about it. I take the word, what word am I going to take? Let's take the word thermoelectric, okay? The word thermoelectric is something that Word2Vec, once trained, will turn into a list of 300 numbers. And in that list of numbers, embedded is the meaning of the word. And there are some interesting things. I think the example is there's certain like invariants in these meanings. So if you take the numbers in the word woman and subtract them from the numbers in the word man, you will get the same. Then if you take queen and then you subtract numbers from the word king, you'll get roughly the same numbers. So there's some funny, but like interesting invariants when you compute these vectors, because it's basically like where it lives in that space of numbers is the meaning of the word. And so you kind of tell which words go together, which words have close meaning. It's all based on which words are near each other in the corpus. So it's not actually trying to learn the grammar. It's just kind of trying to learn using very sophisticated statistical and machine learning techniques, using deep learning,
words are near each other in the corpus. Are you saying that this word is usually found adjacent to or within a certain number of words of this other word?
Exactly.
Or is it some other geometry networking?
Yeah, exactly like that.
Okay.
But it does matter. It's not like, oh, is it just within five of this word? Is it like, you know, is it, you know, skipped to, it uses the information on how many words you skip.
Right.
So it's not just, So
because there's more valuable mapping to be done there than it is the distance less than five, because a distance of three versus a distance, it's not just how far the distance is, because there could be significant meaning to,
right,
certain spacings.
But the important point is it doesn't actually learn the grammar, although you can argue with deep learning you don't really know what's going on. Maybe it's learning pieces of the grammar. But I don't think it really knows the grammar very well. It just is kind of classifying words in a space in a very intelligent way so that the meanings come and appear in these numbers, and then you could use them. You know, these numbers can be used by computers a lot more easily than the words themselves.
Now, is this one of those scenarios where you can quote unquote run the algorithm in reverse and have it spit out intelligent sounding, well constructed scientific thoughts?
No.
And sentences?
No.
No. Okay.
So I don't think it's not really a language model.
Okay.
If that's what you mean, it's like the language models we came up with in episode four when we were doing decryption. It's not a language.
Well, and we've talked about some of the Yeah. I think they're more predictive text models, but yeah. but using algorithms like that to write fiction. Yeah.
Now you can probably use it in a predictive text model. So for example, if you have a word, right, and then let's just say my like n-gram statistical model says like, well, this other word is very likely to come after it. Well, you could use the information word to vec, and if you said, well, if this word is very likely, maybe another word that's similar to it should also be given some weight as well. And so you can use it to make those a lot more intelligent, and you could use those to infer words that could be there even if you haven't seen. So let's give an example, like one word following another. I don't know. It's a tough one to figure out. Like, oh, let me just look at the... Okay, here's one. We're talking about the National Laboratory. So you type in national, and then maybe it thinks laboratory might come next because laboratory is in my corpus after national. I've seen it come after national before. But maybe words that are similar to laboratory might also come after national just because... you know, they're similar words, even though I haven't seen it before. So you could do intelligent things like that with word to vec. Does that make sense? Did I totally go off the rails there? Okay. Cool. And so
don't ask me to do it, but I think it makes sense.
All right. So I do want to ask, like, okay, is this really a machine doing science? And I sort of think it's sort of aiding in the search process, and that's not bad. That's a good thing. But it's more like a recommender system. So it can look at the words and the problem that you're trying to solve, and then it looks at words and other problems that were solved and solutions, and then, you know, it takes your new problem, and then it looks at words that were prevalent in similar problems to find stuff that was that worked. But again, not only does it match the words word for word, it also finds synonyms and similar words, so and relationships between words, so that could be really helpful. And the fact that it maps meaning a little bit, even though it's imperfect, it can be way more sophisticated. But look, I've used word to vec, and it's certainly imperfect when it comes to meaning of words. It's very good statistically, but in terms of, you know, being sure that it's going to get one word right, you can't be reasonably sure.
I would put this at least on par with the publishing of survey papers, where they're taking a number of different works in a specific area and synthesizing them and coming up with some conclusions based on pooling the results of other works that are being done while not doing any new original work. I'd say this is at least on par with that.
Yeah, I think so. They say that they...
Which is a surprising amount of published science being done these days.
So they say they predicted... a discovery that was made more recently by training on past papers, just by kind of looking at, you know, kind of looking at these similarities, looking at these words of vec results.
They put in research papers from before 2009, and it predicted some material that was later developed in like 2012 or something like that.
Yeah, yeah. Now I'd be more impressed if they correctly predicted a future one, suggests that this can be used to suggest future ones, even if it doesn't tell you the answer. Oh, this chemical can do this, but it could be, if you're looking for a solution to the problem on what chemical has these properties I'm looking for, you might have a system like this that can help you search for these chemicals that can give you more than a traditional index might be. So, because right now you could be like, okay, which chemicals have these properties? If they're indexed just based on the words, you might be able to type in those properties and get the chemical out right away. But if it's looking at all the synonyms and the scientific meanings of the words and how they're used and what's kind of associated with each other, you might be able to find more stuff than you otherwise would be able to find.
Yeah, this seems to be coming at a problem. I don't know if we've talked about this on the show before, but there was a some sort of machine learning algorithm that was doing, I believe it was protein folding experiments, and so it was performing these lab experiments in performing them virtually. So it wasn't actually, you know, running robots and performing them in a lab, but it was doing them in a model simulator. And it, because it wasn't doing this in the real world, it was able to do it several orders of magnitude faster than any real lab would be able to. So they could run through millions of scenarios and come out with, you know, these are the 200 most promising combinations that would be worth actually going into the lab and taking a look at. And so that's coming it from kind of a physical model approach.
Yeah.
Whereas this is coming at it from a research literature approach, but providing a similar result, saying this is an area you should look into. I don't know if this is the answer, but there's a high likelihood of promising results down this particular alley, and so it's worth putting real human scientists and real lab resources towards this.
Yeah, I mean, that's almost like engineering design. Like, you simulate a bunch of things and then you find out what works.
Now the real danger would be, and I don't know that this is necessarily any worse than if you were to leave this entirely up to the human scientists and research grad students, but what is to prevent this kind of an algorithm, this kind of machine learning approach, from getting stuck in a local maximum?
Well, we already talked about that. We already talked about that in episode 4. Is that you
there are techniques you can use to get around that, but we don't necessarily know that the people taking this approach are keeping that in mind.
As we know, so
they could very much be sending themselves down not necessarily a blind alley, but cutting themselves off from another very fertile valley of research that's just over that mountain range.
Sure. And again, this is not. This is not like a fact-finding machine. This is a statistical, a very good one, but it's a statistical machine nonetheless. All right, the show notes is on localmaxradio.com/76. Have a great week, everyone. That's the show. Remember to check out the website at localmaxradio.com if you want to contact me, the host, or ask a question that I can answer on the show. Send an email to localmaxradio@gmail.com. This show is available on iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, and more. If you want to keep up, remember to subscribe to The Local Maximum on one of these platforms and to follow my Twitter account @MaxSklar. Have a great week.
Feel the power.